Recently, 160 Queensland public servants and government contractors went to breakfast at a swish Brisbane hotel to learn what ethical behaviour means. This ethics and integrity breakfast was part of a flurry of meetings sparked by a string of scandals. In the past few months in Queensland, a government minister's gone to jail for corruption, and 25 police implicated in exchanging cash and favours with prisoners. On top of that, there's been a lot of hand-wringing about former politicians being paid huge sums for helping businesses win government contracts. On the 20th anniversary of the Fitzgerald Report into corruption in Queensland, former Special Prosecutor Doug Drummond QC told The Breakfast that the government faced a crisis of public confidence.
Some may think it surprising we find ourselves in this situation. Even though we have had an elaborate ethical framework in place for well over a decade, there is a perception that things have run off the rails. How can this have happened?
It's a bad look, and there's a feeling that ethical standards have slipped, not just in the Sunshine State, but everywhere. One of the other speakers at The Breakfast was a Brisbane-based ethics consultant who jets around the world giving talks about corruption to the United Nations and others.
G'day, Howard, it's Ian Townsend.
Inside and outside meetings lately, Howard Witten has been bluntly telling public servants to learn the lessons of the past or risk jail.
My own exposure to mid-level public servants who are doing postgrad studies suggests to me that very many of them have no idea what happened through the 1980s and 1990s in terms of the changes we've been talking about, are deeply ignorant of the proper role and relationship between public servants and ministers, and have no conception of how they should respond to an improper request from a ministerial staffer, for example, for information or to do something.
Hello, I'm Ian Townsend and welcome to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. The World Bank says corruption's at the heart of most of the planet's economic and social trouble. Each year, corrupt officials pocket $1 trillion in bribes. That's $1 million in bribes alone. Corruption in all its forms has been blamed for the global economic crisis. It's been two decades since the Fitzgerald inquiry put a broom through Queensland and sent four government ministers, a police commissioner, and many others to jail for corruption. The public service was overhauled, and Queensland in the early 1990s became the very model of integrity. It was so good, in fact, that most countries around the world now use this Queensland model for fighting corruption. The president of the International Institute of Public Ethics is a Queensland academic, Professor Charles Samford.
It's a reason that Queenslanders should have great pride. Around the world, people will talk about integrity systems and ethics infrastructures and so forth. Some of them call it the Queensland model, but the best thing about it is that most people don't recognise its origins. It's just the way to do it.
But not only do few people recognise the origins of this integrity system, hardly anyone in Queensland knows it exists, let alone how it works. Just down the road from the hotel where the public servants were having breakfast is Fortitude Valley. Here's where Chris Masters stood in 1987 when he described a more familiar Queensland system, one based on corruption, in the Moonlight State for the ABC's Four Corners program.
Some people we've spoken to here in the valley are quite proud of the way things work in Queensland. They say that everything runs smoothly because people here have the right attitude. They understand that you can't stamp out prostitution, you can't stamp out corruption. The very best that you can expect is some form of control. The Queensland system, they argue, has brought peace to the valley.
If so, it's a selective peace. Queensland's prostitution industry appears...
The Queensland system back then was that you can't beat corruption, so you might as well join it. Today, it's a different system, one based on integrity instead of corruption. But the prostitutes are still here. It's the government that now controls the brothels, which pay $25,000 a year for a licence. And corruption's still making headlines.
A former Queensland cabinet minister is spending her first night behind bars. The disgraced former Queensland Labor Minister Gordon Nuttall has been sentenced to 7 years jail in Brisbane.
Robert Needham handed down the CMC's dangerous liaisons report into police misconduct 2 weeks ago. He now says
it does seem like the same old bad news, but the Queensland government's been arguing that this is all proof that Queensland is less corrupt. It's just become better at rooting out corruption.
Thanks very much for that.
You're welcome.
See you later.
In a gentrified back street, not far from the brothels and nightclubs of Fortitude Valley, is a new grey office block that houses Queensland's $43 million a year corruption-fighting agency, the Crime and Misconduct Commission. The head of the CMC is Robert Needham.
Look, one would like to think that everyone would have proper ethical standards within themselves and that they'd always abide by those. But unfortunately, history tells us that human nature being what it is, that there will always be people who will push the envelope for the sake of what can be just bluntly put as being greed. If the opportunities are there to make a good amount of dollars for themselves, they'll take them. In those circumstances, we have to guard society against those people succumbing to those temptations.
We're talking here about the people who turn the wheels of government, public servants, politicians, and police. We're also using the language of bureaucracy. The term integrity means following the rules to the highest ethical standards when doing a job. Corruption's the opposite. It's the misuse of a public paid job for private gain. And it's a perennial problem not just in Queensland, but in all levels of government around the world. Recently, Robert Needham's been using a relatively new term that describes a type of police corruption. It's called noble cause corruption, and it's the ends justifying the means. It's the sort of thing you sometimes see in movies such as Dirty Harry, the rogue cop breaking the rules to bring the bad guys to justice. But it's been shown that this noble cause corruption is the trigger for systemic corruption in the police. A couple of months ago, Queensland's CMC released a report called Dangerous Liaisons, detailing the case of a prisoner called Lee Owen Henderson, who was given favours and cash for information to pin crimes on other people, a classic case of police bending the rules for a noble cause. Robert Needham.
The rationale that's used is, well, we know they're guilty, we get them in the end, so it doesn't matter if we bend the rules on the way through. So it's exactly that, noble cause corruption. It's the start, it can be the start of a slippery slope, that once you start lying, say, to a court, once you start bending the rules in those sorts of ways and doing the unethical thing, it's then easier to do the next unethical thing and the next one after that. And we see instances of it in that particular report where they start off doing the wrong thing and then a little while later they're accepting money from this prisoner. That's the way it goes. They're accepting $1,000. If you don't watch it in 6 months' time, they'll be accepting $10,000 and on it goes.
So this is when integrity starts going out the window.
Integrity breaks down, exactly. That it's normally, it's the old thing that from little things, big things grow. Most instances don't start off with a public servant taking $1 million. It starts off with the taking of the $10 and grows on from there.
Robert Needham, a lawyer who was a counsel advising Tony Fitzgerald during the corruption inquiry in the late 1980s. He's one of a cadre of people from this era who've spent their careers in what's become an anti-corruption industry based in Queensland. They've been thinking deeply about what went wrong back then and how to stop it happening again. Another person who was a significant figure in the Fitzgerald era is retired Uniting Church minister Noel Preston. He says this ability to justify to ourselves almost anything we do as noble, or at least excusable, is one of the most corrupting sides of human behaviour. Noel Preston.
This capacity for self-justification, it's the very reason why we have to cultivate amongst public officials a capacity to step back from their situation and double-check it with a more objective advice-giving function, because we've got to approach these situations, be they gifts, be they part of your so-called entitlements, with the knowledge that none of us at the end of the day, can be exempt from some capacity to self-deceive in this regard.
Are we all prone to this, that lead us not into temptation?
Well, indeed. Indeed, I think that has to be the starting point, the assumption that the mix of a noble profession like politics, which is also a morally ambiguous activity, with flawed individual human beings is a potent mix that we ought to approach always with a sense of, there but for the grace of God go I.
A big dose of self-interest is also needed to lead us into a more ethical world. The motivation for both corruption and integrity is usually money. Until the early 1990s, the World Bank saw corruption only as a political problem and believed it was none of its business. But then a New Zealand lawyer, Jeremy Pope, working as an advisor to the World Bank, pointed out that corruption must be an economic problem if it meant loans and aid were being squandered. The World Bank agreed and started insisting that if countries wanted help, they had to clean up their public service. In the early 1990s, Jeremy Pope had also been working for the Commonwealth Secretariat. Crossing his desk were piles of documents detailing a range of new reforms designed to stop corruption in Queensland, and he had a eureka moment. Jeremy Pope's on the line from Wellington in New Zealand.
And looking at them, it occurred to me that they were actually looking at a single system, where the institutions relate to each other and, in a sense, watch each other, and you have elements of horizontal accountability at work. So I started developing basically the concept of the National Integrity System from all the work that had been done arising out of the Queensland disaster.
Jeremy Pope founded the corruption watchdog Transparency International and used this Queensland model as the basis for what he called a national integrity system. It was a big idea that started attracting charity money, and so to protect it, Jeremy Pope took out the patent, the intellectual property rights, on the national integrity system. Despite its dull and uninspiring name, the idea of a national integrity system took off.
To my amazement, it's been picked up by so many people that it's been translated into over 25 different languages, and most recently into Kurdish.
Who's picked it up?
All sorts of people. You know, it may be activists in Kurdistan, it may be university faculties in China, NGOs, UNDP, AusAid, and, you know, various agencies working to their own agendas.
Is it still coming from Transparency International? Who owns the IP?
Well, I suppose theoretically I have the intellectual property, but we regard it basically as public goods. It was paid for with charity money. It was done in the public interest, and we pushed it out into the public ether, which basically means that nobody owns it, so that everybody can have it.
The World Bank, the United Nations, and UNESCO all use variations of the National Integrity System. You can find a link to Jeremy Pope's diagram of a National Integrity System on the Background Briefing website. It's hard to describe briefly, but imagine a Greek temple with a dozen pillars holding up the roof. The pillars represent parts of society and government. The terms change, but basically you could put in a parliament, an ombudsman, the courts, the public service, the public, the media, an anti-corruption agency, and so on. Along the top is a big stone lintel holding up three balls. These are the things we'd like society to be: peaceful through the rule of law, prosperous through good government, and happy. If one of the pillars falls over, the lintel drops and all the balls roll on the ground. It's a sort of recipe for a good society. Others preferred to think of it as a bird's nest rather than a temple. The nest keeps unravelling and has to be constantly rebuilt. Back in Queensland in 1989, Tony Fitzgerald warned in his report that his package of reforms needed eternal vigilance. Here's a reading of what he said.
Institutions become corrupt or inefficient because of the attitudes of those who work within them, and the corruption and inefficiency are factors which cause such attitudes to persist. Innovations will be sterile and impotent if attitudes do not change. If the community is complacent, future leaders will revert to former practices.
In other words, the government will let things slide if they're allowed to get away with it. That was 20 years ago.
Please join me in making welcome the Honourable Tony Fitzgerald.
At Brisbane's Griffith University 2 months ago, on the 20th anniversary of the Fitzgerald Report, Tony Fitzgerald launched a scathing attack on the Queensland government for letting things slide too far.
Secrecy was re-established by sham claims that voluminous documents were cabinet in confidence. Access can now be purchased, patronage is dispensed, mates and supporters are appointed, and retired politicians exploit their connections to obtain success fees for deals between business and government. Neither side of politics is interested in these issues except for short-term political advantage, as each enjoys or plots impatiently for its turn at the privileges and opportunities which accompany power.
One of the many triggers for this broadside was the jailing in the past 2 years of two former Queensland cabinet ministers. Former Tourism Minister Mary Rose was jailed for trying to blackmail the then Premier Peter Beattie, and former Health Minister Gordon Nuttall was jailed earlier this year on 36 counts of corruptly receiving secret commissions. Tony Fitzgerald's lecture was organised by Griffith University's Institute for Ethics, Governance and Law. Its director is Professor Charles Samford.
I've got to say, my response is, how on earth did they think they were going to get away with it? Because it's been pointed out, it was some of the integrity reforms that actually made it pretty easy for once the suspicion has been raised to actually have them in court and have them convicted. And that's the whole point of an integrity system, is to actually you design your incentives and sanctions in such a way as that you channel people into the right behaviour.
This is the beauty of an integrity system if it's working. It steers people towards the right course, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because the consequences of not doing it are dire. After the recent cases of corruption exposed in Queensland, some suggested Queensland had already slid back to the bad old days. The headlines asked, why is Queensland so corrupt? Charles Samford.
This is the big question, is if you see some corruption, is it that the state is more corrupt, or is it merely that their mechanisms are more likely to lead to reports of corruption and convictions of corruption? The most corrupt states will probably have very few convictions of corruption. The least corrupt states will have very few convictions of corruption. But in the meantime, you will expect actually an increase in corruption perceptions and an increase in corruption prosecutions. And so it's often hard to tell whether in fact the increase is due to the problem getting better or the solution becoming more effective.
The behaviour that's being exposed in big scandals around the world lately is politicians misusing their allowances. Last month, Australia's Auditor-General, Ian McPhee, released a report showing that 74% of federal politicians were using their office printing allowances for things they weren't supposed to, such as printing how-to-vote cards. It mightn't seem like corruption, but they're running a big risk. In Queensland 20 years ago, the four National Party ministers who went to jail as a result of the Fitzgerald inquiry into corruption were locked up not because of bribes or links to corrupt police, but because they were found to have misused allowances. In the UK this year, the misuse of allowances is one of the things threatening to topple the British government. British MPs are allowed to claim expenses that include accommodation when they're in London for Parliament. But that's been so broadly interpreted that MPs were claiming allowances for all sorts of things, including renovating their homes. One claimed money for cleaning the moat of his country house. In New Zealand, Transparency International did an audit of that country's national integrity system and found that parliamentary allowances there were being misused. They argued for reform, but it didn't happen. A founder of Transparency International, Jeremy Pope, is now the New Zealand Human Rights Commissioner.
Now, of course, we see huge scandals in the New Zealand Parliament because they ignored it.
Parliamentary allowances are a real pitfall, it seems, for politicians around the world, aren't they? We've had a big scandal in the UK and here in Queensland, questions are being asked as well now.
Yeah, well, it's just everywhere. And, of course, the parliamentarians see themselves as sitting next to God and accountable to none. So it's rather difficult to clamp accountability measures on them.
The problem is trying to get politicians and police to change the very laws that will let them off the hook if they behave badly. Before the Fitzgerald inquiry in the 1980s, the best anti-corruption model came from Hong Kong. The government there set up the Independent Commission Against Corruption, or ICAC. It's this model that was brought to New South Wales by Nick Greiner to clean up corruption in that state in the late 1980s. The ICAC model was developed in Hong Kong in 1974. It employed police and had a tough do-whatever-it-takes approach to finding and locking up crooks. It's an approach to policing that inspired the 1975 movie The Man from Hong Kong.
See Jimmy Wang Yu as the tough Hong Kong cop who learned every trick in the book, then threw the book away.
Directed and written by Brian Trenchard-Smith, it's the story of a Hong Kong cop sent to Sydney to bring an evil Australian drug lord to justice. Inspector Wang brings the Hong Kong style of policing to Australia, beats up the villains, and shows the corrupt Australian police how things are done. It's a display of that noble cause corruption that the Crime and Misconduct Commission's Robert Needham described earlier. 2 decades ago, when Tony Fitzgerald was cleaning up Queensland, he rejected the Hong Kong ICAC model, which he believed relied too heavily on police. In Queensland, the police were part of the problem. Most of the corruption was within the police licensing branch, the vice squad that patrolled the illegal nightclubs and brothels. The owners bribed licensing branch officers to leave them alone. Back then, 2 syndicates controlled the illegal Brisbane brothels and clubs. One was run by Jerry Bellino and Vic Conti, and the other by Hector Happeter. In 1987, the ABC's Four Corners program, The Moonlight State, focused on corruption in the licensing branch.
Finding a policeman who would open the shutters on the licensing branch at one time seemed an impossibility. But Nigel Powell, who has now resigned from the force, agreed to talk.
As far as I was concerned, in my time, there were 2 groups. I can't talk in terms of 1 syndicate, but as far as I was concerned, there were 2 groups operating, the Bellino-Conti group and the Tilly Happeter group.
How did you regard them?
These people were charged after the Fitzgerald inquiry and most went to jail. Whistleblower Nigel Powell left Queensland and went to New South Wales. Now back in Queensland, Nigel Powell lives in a rented house on the outskirts of Brisbane.
You're right.
Now, I'm only going to say this.
In an ironic twist, he rents his cottage from a businessman who was once a bouncer at one of the Bellino family's Fortitude Valley clubs.
I unfortunately do not have a career as a police officer. I didn't have one, no.
Is that something you would have liked to have gone back into?
Yeah, very much.
Why did that happen?
I didn't think it was safe for me to go back into Queensland. I'm a rat, I'm a dog. That was my reputation in those days, even when the inquiry was on.
Were you threatened at all?
By police? Not directly, no. Did I trust them? No. Not at all. Part of the culture is you don't dob on your mates. I think I'd have had to have rocks in my head to rejoin the Queensland Police. And, hey, I'll tell you what, nobody offered.
The Fitzgerald inquiry relied heavily on whistleblowers. But despite a Whistleblower Protection Act in 1994, many by then had had their careers wrecked. Back at the CMC offices in Fortitude Valley, I've asked to see a bottle of scotch that was presented to the Fitzgerald inquiry as evidence of corruption 20 years ago.
What have we got here?
It's a bottle of Chivas Regal that was, I think, tendered as an exhibit during the Fitzgerald inquiry.
And this is Col Dillon's bribe.
So. Yep. That he didn't open and left on the shelf. And it's obviously a very good one.
Don't drop it. So this is a pretty expensive bottle of
very
scotch.
Expensive, yes.
This bottle of Chivas Regal was used to try to bribe another whistleblower, Cole Dillon, who back in the 1980s was a young Indigenous officer in the licensing branch. He'd been offered the bribe by a senior officer. Cole Dillon spoke last year to the ABC's Speaking Out program about the day he became a whistleblower.
I'd contacted the investigative team. They came out to my place. I can remember it was a Sunday night. A fellow came out there and started taking notes, and then I just said, oh, look, up there on the mantelpiece, I said, that green velvet sack. I said, that contains one of the bribes. I said, it's a bottle of Chivas Regal scotch. And he said, is it really? I said, yep. He said, what are you going to do with that? I said, well, I said, I would tender that in evidence. I said, that'd be a tangible piece of evidence to show that, hey, that is a bribe that I'm able to give first-hand evidence about.
That's Cole Dillon, who rose to the rank of inspector and has since resigned from the force, unhappy in recent years with the way the Queensland government handled the investigation into a death in custody on Palm Island. Back in the 1970s and 80s, the Bjelke-Petersen government made street protests illegal and had the police enforce that policy. Uniting Church Minister Noel Preston had founded a group called Concerned Christians, which supported other protesters with picket lines. They were often arrested while singing, as they were in this ABC News report from 1985.
Otherwise you will be arrested.
The Concerned Christians resumed singing. Without warning this time, the police moved in again. Labor MP Pat Comben was taken. It was his first picket line. Several of the Concerned Christians followed him.
We always move on when the police ask us to move on. The aim of the whole thing is a peaceful picket.
Noel Preston, now retired, remembers several run-ins with the police.
They institutionally carry the power of the state on the streets all the time. And so they are under grave temptation constantly. And unless we protect them by putting around them very demanding measures of accountability, we are setting them up. And the police will act with a belief that they're acting for the greater good. I'm sure the Bjelke-Petersen police force, in fact, one or two of them actually said it to me in the watch house one day, really believed that they were the defenders of morality, and they should be being supported rather than being challenged.
The temptations in their jobs make police and politicians more vulnerable than the rest of us to corruption. There's a duty here, not just for the police and politicians to behave ethically, but for the rest of us to make sure the rules for them are clear and that they can't get into trouble.
Things like the corporate box entertainment at a football match. Now, that's, to some, doesn't sound like a big thing, but I think it's a very slippery slope that started. It can be a subversive influence on a minister, a young member of parliament whose name might be Nuttall, and so on, and so on. And that's why, even though it also looks like a rather trite thing to do, it's necessary for these sorts of gifts and hospitality to be publicly declared, albeit on a register that's hardly looked at by anyone except the Clerk of Parliament and an occasional academic or journalist. But in the process of declaring the gift, declaring the hospitality, and of meeting some external standard about how far you can go, a member of parliament and a public official has to think twice, thrice about, you know, are we establishing some obligation, mutual obligation here, which will undermine my capacity to act truly towards my vocation as a politician or as a senior public servant.
You might have seen the television series The Sopranos. It's one of the world's most successful TV shows, and it's set in the underworld of New Jersey. The Sopranos starts with this song. You woke up this morning, got yourself a gun. Your mama always said you'd be the chosen one. She said it, one in a million. You got to burn the shine, but you love going under a bad sign with a blue moon in your eyes. That's the song Woke Up This Morning by British band Alabama 3 for the TV show The Sopranos. The Sopranos tells the story of mafia boss Tony Soprano as he tries to balance his personal life with his crime syndicate. In an American state like New Jersey, it cuts close to the bone. Local journalist Bob Ingalls has chronicled corruption in New Jersey in a book called The Soprano State.
We call it The Soprano State because much of the world knows New Jersey because of the HBO TV series The Sopranos, because it's based in New Jersey. And we contend that the government of New Jersey treats taxpayers like the way the mob treats the people they deal with.
And how's that?
Well, it sort of makes them a deal they can't refuse, beats them up, and leaves them in an alley someplace.
Bob Ingalls works for the Gannett newspapers in the city of Trenton, New Jersey's state capital. Trenton has a population of about 80,000, but many parts are poor, with broken pavements, abandoned buildings, shootings, and dilapidated schools. A lot of the money's been sucked out of the city centre and into wealthier suburbs. Within 10 minutes of the poverty are palatial homes and suburbs of leafy streets where kids ride bikes and sell lemonade on summer evenings on the sidewalk. New Jersey is a contrast of wealthy, secure suburbia and third world dilapidation. And that's mostly because of corruption, says Bob Ingalls.
Whatever it is, New Jersey is more accepting of this kind of corruption than other states. So it's a part of the culture.
And that's almost then a tacit approval for politicians to try to rot the system.
You bet. If you think there's a chance that you'll never get caught, if you are so inclined to do something illegal or unethical, then you might go ahead and play the odds, which apparently is what happens here, because some of the corruption that you see going on is for small amounts of money, $2,000 or something. You'll have somebody who'll be making pretty good salary in a public job, and then they will go out of their way to steal $1,500. It doesn't make any sense.
There are many stories of corruption in New Jersey, but recently one case topped them all. In July, 44 people were arrested as part of an investigation into corruption that involved money laundering and the sale of body parts. One of those charged was accused of buying kidneys from donors in Israel for $10,000 and selling them in the US for $160,000 each.
Federal agents started the roundup at 6 a.m., arresting mayors and state legislators in New Jersey and rabbis in a parallel case in New York, 44 in all.
New Jersey's corruption problem is one of the worst, if not the worst, in the nation. Corruption is not only pervasive, it has become ingrained in New Jersey's political culture.
Newspaper journalist Bob Ingalls also wrote about this case in his columns.
Ordinary corruption in New Jersey involves public officials taking money, having three or four jobs they don't do but get paid for, and that kind of thing. Having money laundering by rabbis and having body parts being sold is weird, even for New Jersey.
And some of the people arrested included the president of the Jersey City Council, I think, and a mayor.
There was a state assemblyman arrested, and a couple of mayors, and it was all across the board. Ordinarily, when they do these busts, they bring them in a bus to be processed. This time, it took three buses to get them all in. There were so many of them, and it was something surreal that you were looking at it, but you really couldn't believe it. There were all these rabbis and these people being let off the bus in handcuffs.
It's so outrageous. It's funny, isn't it? Why is that, I wonder? I suppose it's the essence of a certain type of joke, something that's so outlandish it makes you want to laugh.
It is like a joke, isn't it? I mean, it's almost, you like say, well, a rabbi and a mayor and a developer go into a bar. It sounds like the start of a joke. But the thing about it is some of this money was transferred in bars and in parking lots.
In Queensland 20 years ago, there was a fair bit of corruption, more than there is now. The police had a term for the bribes they were paid by the local crooks, and it was called the joke.
The joke. We call it the corruption tax.
In fact, New Jersey's one of the highest tax states in the US. On the other side of New Jersey, in Newark, the former head of the Australian Institute of Criminology, Adam Graycar, teaches at the School of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University.
So much of the taxes that people pay are paid in overpriced infrastructure, in jobs for politicians and their friends, in manipulation of the state, in the state buying products at much greater prices, paying rents that are higher than market rents because some politician might own the building that the public servants have been moved to, and there was a case of that just recently, and the politician has just gone to jail. Incredibly complex rules and regulations that nobody could ever understand, and the only way to get through it all is to offer some inducement to some sort of inspector.
6 months ago, Adam Graycar started the Rutgers Institute on Corruption Studies.
In New Jersey, it seems there is no culture of integrity. I was talking to another professor the other day who teaches a course on ethics, and she was telling me she had all the city officials in and was doing an executive course with them and talking about ethics. And she said it was so hard for them to see that having lunch with developers and builders every week, they couldn't see that if you could buy a building cheap and then sell it later, that that was a conflict of interest. And these are things that in most other places people see immediately as a conflict of interest.
In Queensland back in the 1980s, it was the same problem. You might remember Russ Hinds, who at one time was Minister for Local Government, Roads, Racing and Police, earning him the title as Minister for Everything. He also owned hotels and racehorses. When asked about these conflicts of interest, he said, "That's not a conflict of interest, that's a convergence of interest." It's a quote made famous at the time by comedian Max Gillies, but it's a good way of describing the difficulty that public officials sometimes have in recognising conflicts of interest. Lately, there's been growing concern about the influence professional lobbyists are having on governments. It's come to a head in Queensland, with reports that two former Labor politicians, Terry McEnroth and Con Schacker, shared a success fee believed to be $500,000 after the Bris Connections Consortium won a $4.8 billion contract to build a road and tunnel to the Brisbane airport. They did nothing illegal, but it's become a bad look for a government defending its integrity. It suggests that former politicians can still wield some influence in government. The rise of the professional lobbyist is an example of a corporate culture creeping into politics and the public service, says ethicist and retired Uniting Church minister Noel Preston.
There's been a synergy there, regrettably, between selfish commerce and selfish politics, which has probably peaked around this phenomenon of the lobbyists and these lobby companies, which are full of people who do what? I'm not sure. Grease the monkey and dirty their hands and a few other people in the same process. This commerce government connection does certainly need tidying up.
Lobbying has become such a prickly issue in Queensland that the Premier, Anna Bligh, has made public a list of all lobbyists the government deals with. It reads like a who's who of former government politicians, staffers and senior bureaucrats. She also changed the rules so that ex-MPs and senior bureaucrats have to wait 18 months to 2 years before they can become lobbyists to try to reduce their ability to exploit connections they might have made as public servants. It's not the lobbyist who has the conflict of interest here. It's the public servant who might be called on to do a private favour. The Crime and Misconduct Commission's head, Robert Needham.
But we do know that there will always be some individuals who, through their own force of personality or perhaps through the degree of influence they have into their old political party, their length of time during which they can wield perhaps undue influence with other people will be even longer than 2 years. And I don't comment on any of the rights or wrongs of it, but we see suggestions of that with Mr. Burke in Western Australia, who's been out of power now for, I don't know what, it must be 15 years or so. So you can't really guard against those. You can't preclude someone from working in certain areas for periods of 15 years. That's just not appropriate to do, to guard against those particular unique individuals. So all you can do is put a reasonable period upon it so that you hope that their degree of influence wanes during that time.
In Western Australia last month, former Labor MP Shelley Archer had corruption charges against her dropped. That state's Corruption and Crime Commission alleged that she had handed a confidential letter about the relocation of the Broome International Airport to a friend and lobbyist who was acting on behalf of that airport. The lobbyist was former WA Premier Brian Burke. After the charges were dropped, Shelley Archer spoke to reporters.
Did you want to speculate on why these charges were brought at all? I mean, does it puzzle you?
I think the only reason that the charges were brought is because there's one trait I do have, and that is loyalty, and loyalty to my friends, and I maintain that then and I maintain it now.
Can you elaborate on that at all?
No, I can't. I think you know what I'm talking about.
Brian Burke's apparent influence on the West Australian government has lasted a long time. It's been 20 years since he was Premier and 15 years since he was jailed for rorting travel expenses. It was a Western Australia's Corruption and Crime Commission that investigated this case. There aren't many agencies around the country that can even start to investigate cases like this. The only Australian governments that have independent anti-corruption agencies are Western Australia, Queensland, and New South Wales. There's no independent agency watching politicians or the public service in the federal government. It's one thing to have tough corruption-fighting bodies. The other thing you need, says ethicist Noel Preston, is more respect for the idea of public service.
There's scope for re-understanding public life in terms that you might say are quasi-theological. Why do we not now talk about public service so much? We talk about the public sector, we talk about public officials, but public service. One key theme is the rather quaint idea these days of vocation, calling. In the case of public office, am I faithful to the public good? Am I putting the right primacy on the public interest? Am I truly a public servant?
Queensland's Public Sector Ethics Act of 1994 was one of the first in the world to spell out ethics for public servants. In effect, it says, respect the law, respect people, recognise that you're in a position of trust, do your job with diligence or care, and don't waste resources. That seems straightforward, but for all the good intentions, it's always been hard to get people to resist temptation when it comes along. It's part of an age-old philosophical debate about the nature of good and evil, whether it's something inside us all or a part of a larger battle between God and the devil. Professor Charles Samford of Griffith University refers to 19th century German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach.
Feuerbach said that whereas some Christians believe that God created man in his own image, it's probably at least as likely that man created God in his own image, and he also created the devil and projected onto God and the devil the good and the evil within him. For me, the thing is that I'm agnostic as to whether there is a God or not, agnostic as to whether Feuerbach is right or whether the Christians were right, or even as to whether that's an appropriate interpretation of Feuerbach. But I think that it's a question of each individual trying to understand what, for him or her, is the right behaviour and the wrong behaviour. But you need to have institutional structures which actually help them. But also to then say, well, yeah, you believe that, that's fine. But if you believe that and act on it, you can't be part of this institution or you may well go to jail.
These institutional structures, the codes of conduct and the corruption watchdogs, are just as important in the private sector. The current global financial crisis has exposed some huge financial scandals. Take the collapse of the investment bank Lehman Brothers, the exposure of US financier Bernie Madoff as a multi-billion dollar fraudster, and even the precarious position of the people of Iceland after their banks collapsed, sending the country broke. In Australia, there's the spectacular collapse of Storm Financial. Investors with the Townsville-based financial planner lost as much as $3 billion when the share market crashed. Last month, a federal joint parliamentary committee chaired by federal MP Bernie Ripoll interrogated the head of Storm, Emmanuel Casamatis.
If your clients seemed concerned, why weren't you concerned? You're their advisor.
Because I trusted
that the system that had always worked would continue working.
So you trusted other people's money with somebody else's trust?
Well, of course, that's what you do.
But no documents, no legal contracts, no... You know, I'm just not sure. But you based your trust on what? Normally we based our trust in documents that we sign a contract, that we understand exactly what happens at what point. You relied your trust on what?
Well, you trust on an institution such as the CBA. If you can't trust that type of institution, which institution can you trust?
Sorry, since when have we been able to trust the banks? Sorry, since when? just give me a date. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
The good news from all of this is that increasingly governments and businesses are looking more closely at their own ethics and transparency. They have to, because the internet's exposing them to greater scrutiny. At the start of the program, we heard from Howard Witten, an ethics consultant to several United Nations agencies. He's also with the Australian New Zealand School of Government at the University of Canberra. Howard Witten says the rise of the internet means bad behaviour isn't easily forgotten, and so there's suddenly a big demand for ethics advisers around the world.
Technology, the internet, means that the effects are there for the world to see forever, and they're not under your control if you're the agency that's the subject of the scandal. Once upon a time, if there'd been a scandal in your organisation, it might have made it to the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald for a couple of days, or if it was really big for a week, or if it was a Royal Commission matter, then for a year or so. But within 6 months, the salient details are mostly forgotten. Most people have got tired of it. Within 3 years, no one can remember that the matter ever happened. But if you want to look at Enron or the BAE scandal, you can go to Google and you can get back every document, most of the transcribed SMSs and telephone conversations and all the rest of it, which is there on the web for all to see forever. That makes a difference, and I suspect that's one of the things, technology in fact, is one of the things that's driving the reforms in the integrity and government area as much as any legislation we might have passed.
Howard Witten. There will always be people in power who will be tempted to abuse it. Professor Charles Sanford says the key is to recognise that and design governments that can be run by people who aren't perfect.
I think some people have an image of an ethical person as somebody who, with all the temptations, with all the pressures in the world, does the right thing, a great sacrifice. We never have enough of them to fill a cabinet room, let alone man every beat or every social welfare office. And so what we should really do is to try to design institutions that, you know, can be run by ordinary people. Because I think that if you have to rely on, you know, people being saints, then in that case there just will never be enough saints to go around. And the other thing is that probably if saints stood for election, they probably wouldn't be chosen. So overall, let's design institutions that don't need saints to run them.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. Technical production by Mark Don. The executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. I'm Ian Townsend, and you're listening to ABC Radio National.
Do you find it annoying when driving between towns you can't tune to Radio National? Well, this summer, don't put up with it. Take Beachpod with you. At Beachpod, you can load up your MP3 player with loads of great Radio National podcasts. They're listed in various topics, and there's bound to be one that takes your fancy. For all the details, drive straight to the Radio National homepage, abc.net.au/rn.